This is Vis-a-Vis, a podcast series brought to you by the Alliance Program at Columbia University. Vis-a-Vis features conversations that challenge our understanding of key global, economic, and social issues by casting them in a transatlantic perspective. I'm Emmanuel Catan. I head the Alliance Program, a partnership between Columbia University and three French universities, Sciences Po, Paris Panthéon-Sorbonne, and École Polytechnique. Every episode, I sit down face-to-face with, or as we say in French, vis-a-vis, some of the most insightful thinkers on both sides of the Atlantic. I hope you enjoy our conversation. On April 15th, 2019, the world saw in awe the Notre Dame Cathedral ravaged by flames. As the fire spread through the beloved Paris landmark, toxic smoke spewed billions of particles of lead from the collapsing roof and spire. In the weeks that followed the disaster, experts and civil society groups raised the alarm about the risk of lead exposure for Paris residents and workers on the Notre Dame site, and drew media attention on an issue that affects millions of people worldwide. Indeed, lead poisoning can cause neurological, renal, and cardiovascular problems, especially in children. Still today, lead can be found in old paintwork, dyes, cosmetics, toys, and batteries. 800 million children, one in three worldwide, are exposed to lead, and according to the World Bank, lead is responsible for at least 5 million deaths each year. To shed light on this global challenge, Vis-a-Vis is honored to welcome two experts, Judith Rainhorn of Paris Panthéon-Sorbonne and Columbia geochemist Lex Van Ghen. Judith Rainhorn is a professor in modern history at Paris Panthéon-Sorbonne University. Her research interests include the history of medicine and health, urban history, environmental and labor history in France, Europe, and the United States, on which she has published extensively. Her most recent book is entitled Blanc de Plomb, Histoire d'un Poison Légal. Geochemist Lex Van Ghen holds a research professor appointment at Le Mont-Doherty Earth Observatory, and is a member of the Earth Institute's faculty at Columbia University. His current work focuses on ways to reduce the impact of the environment on human health and includes research on fluoride in groundwater in India, bauxite dust in Guinea, and lead-contaminated soil in Peru mines. In October 2024, Lex Van Ghen and Judith Rainhorn organized a workshop on reducing lead pollution at the Columbia Maison Française with the support of the Alliance Program. Professor Rainhorn, let me start with you. Could you tell us what is lead pollution and how widespread is this problem around the world? What are the effects of lead pollution on humans and particularly on children? And how many people are impacted by this worldwide?
I have to say today, lead pollution is an issue that is widely underestimated, both by public authorities in most countries and by the general public worldwide, who often consider it to be an old and outdated problem. As a historian, I can confirm it is an old problem, a very old problem. I would say traces of lead poisoning have been found in human dental remains from prehistoric times. Some historians actually have claimed for long that the fall of the Roman Empire would be partly linked to lead poisoning of Roman elites drinking water due to the use of lead pipes in the city of Rome. It's a rather doubtful story, especially as it would only have affected the urban population, which were far from being the majority of the Roman Empire population. But I have to say a recent paper published in the PNAS Proceedings of National Academy of Science in January 2025 suggests that lead concentration in the air, mostly coming from silver and lead mining, were sufficiently high to cause neurological effects across the European population. So I have to say since that time, very ancient times, that potential and effective routes for human exposure have increased a lot, including lead in water pipes, but also pottery and kitchenware, ornaments, cosmetics, and paint. I have to say all sorts of paint, like paint on toys, for example, and mostly paint on buildings since the 19th century, mostly. And in all the workplaces and production sites regarding these industrial activities. My book, Blanc de Plomb, you addressed before, which was published in 2019, and I have to say is to be published in English this coming year, highlights the significant role played by lead pollution in urban spaces and in the industrial machine since the 19th century, particularly in the manufacture of white paint, which has been supported by massive urban growth in Europe and North America over the past two centuries, to the extent that lead poisoning had become one of the most widespread, often unidentified disease, in the sense that the general atmosphere has become progressively lead-loaded, affecting both workers in these sectors and the general population. So after and at the same time as paint, the use of leaded gasoline, of course, which began in the US in the 1920s and spread globally for decades, nearly a century on the wild world scale, played a major part in the ubiquitous spread of lead on the planet today, along with the massive growth of the car industry, of course. So today, lead is probably one of those eternal pollutants that is very difficult, if not impossible, to get rid of. And despite efforts to eliminate it from a number of industrial processes, lead is still present in many consumer goods, as you said, old paints, of course, but also foodstuffs, dyes, cosmetics, PVC piping, electric batteries, concrete, toys or ammunitions, and so on. So what are the effects of lead on human health, you asked? Well, they are manifold, I would say, sometimes giving rise to non-specific symptoms, which means that lead poisoning is quite often slow to be spotted by doctors. In fact, lead has serious effects on many functions of the human body, on the digestive system, on the general neurological system, and can lead to encephalopathy and even death in both adults and children. It has effects also on blood pressure and cardiovascular disease, but also kidney functioning, reproduction, mental development, and the central nervous system. So you're right to note that it is particularly serious in children, as almost 50% of ingested lead passes into the children's bloodstream, as opposed to only about 10% in adults. This means that for the same level of lead contamination, the toxic effects of lead are more severe in children. It causes learning difficulties, intellectual and psychomotor disabilities, slow general growth, and a drop in IQ levels. And all these effects are permanent, even at low doses. So finally, I would like to point out that lead is eliminated from the body very slowly after exposure. Its half-life is 15 to 20 years. So as you can see, all this makes lead a real threat to human health, now considered a cancer-causing agent, toxic for human reproduction, and the carrier of numerous toxicities in most international classification of toxic products. What's important to remember is that lead poisoning is not a disease of the past. It is not a minor and peripheral or outdated problem.
Absolutely. And given how widespread this and how grave this problem is, as you mentioned, it's a little bit surprising that we don't hear more about it and that it doesn't really emerge in the media as often as it should. In fact, the Notre Dame fire was really an opportunity to raise the issue. Regarding the fire itself and in the following days of the Notre Dame fire, there was mounting evidence that lead from the roof and spire had burned and that particles from these parts of the cathedral had been released in the air around the city of Paris. you, Professor Van Ghen, led a study in December 2019 where you collected a number of soil samples around Paris in parks and public places around the cathedral. I'm wondering what was the purpose of the actual study, and what did you discover? What did you find out?
So, you know, as you said, we all followed what was happening with horror in April 2019. What really struck me is that it took, I think, a couple of weeks before an environmental organization called Robin des Bois sounded the alarm and brought up the issue of lead, in particular in the context of the workers who had to clean up the cathedral, as well as the population around it. And what struck me of that event, and that stays with me, is that this organization did it before any sort of official channel from the government provided a warning. I think it's something to remember. I hope it is a lesson for the future as well. So, like everyone else, I had read that 400 tons of lead, that the roofs of Notre Dame accounted for that. A lot of that vaporized. Many of us have seen the video, this yellow cloud going towards the west. But I think there was a French government contract organization estimated that about 0.1 tons, about 100 kilograms of lead had traveled to the west with that plume. And I thought that this was an enormous difference between the two, and I'd seen the flames, but that particular report indicated very clearly this was beyond a kilometer perimeter around the cathedral. And so that got me thinking, well, is there something that we could do to constrain what's happening within the kilometer? I've studied lead in various contexts, mining in particular. So what I did know is that when lead falls, particles fall on soil, typically it sticks to it it's not going to travel far away. I did know that firefighters and others had been flushing the streets, and so I wouldn't find any trace of that. There had been in the news already over the summer concern about school and the dust deposited on desks and things like that. And so I thought, well, let's try to get an idea of what it is. And so I designed a very simple plan. I thought, okay, let's draw two circles around Notre Dame. One, I think, had a 200 meter radius, the other 400 meters. We knew which way the wind was blowing. The reason I designed these circles initially is I said, well, if there is a directional component, that will be sort of evidence that even if it's a noisy signal, that it could be attributed to the place. So that's all I did. And so the challenge there was essentially finding spots where soil was unlikely to have been disturbed. And so I ended up going to parks and a lot of tree pits and try to take a small sample of soil. And I first tested those with a little kit that was developed in my lab. And it turned out the levels were not sufficiently high to reliably be detected by the kits. But when we brought them back to the US, we analyzed them by X-ray fluorescence. And there we could see a pattern. So we saw a pattern towards the west, and that then led to additional sampling, looking for soil to the west of the cathedral. And then working with a statistician, we tried to integrate that. And we calculated that on the order of 1 ton of excess lead was probably deposited to the west of the cathedral, but essentially 10 times more than that the other agency had calculated was transported below a kilometer. And so that sounded plausible to me. You have an enormous amount on the roofs, not all of it's burned away, volatilized. We know some of it goes, beyond the kilometers, so 0.1 tons, and then 1 ton just around it. I thought that was a useful constraint. So it started from a very simple idea, this directional component, and the notion that if there was lead deposited, it's not been flushed away everywhere.
Right. And you realized that in the direction of the wind, the deposits were actually characteristic of what you would find in other cases of soil contamination. In other words, that the number of particles was significantly higher than what regulators would deem to be the acceptable level.
So that's an interesting point. They were somewhat elevated. I mean, to the west was clearly higher than to the east. On average, these levels weren't super high. The U.S. has recently lowered its threshold to 200 ppm lead in soil in areas where children bear soil in areas where children play. I think the average was, the variations were between 400 and 800. So higher, but not an order of magnitude higher like you would find in, next to a mine, a lead mine, for instance. So it was, I would say, still a fairly subtle signal. I don't think the soil contamination itself posed a big hazard. It's hard to know whether the dust did for a number of days, including in schools.
Right. So there was, as you said, quite a lot of civil society mobilization. You mentioned also the Robin des Bois Association. But despite all of these discussions that were taking place in the follow-up and in the reconstruction phase of the Notre Dame Cathedral, a decision was made in the end that the restoration would use lead yet again to cover the roof structures of the nave and the choir. Judith, did this decision surprise you? And would there have been an alternative to the use of lead in the restoration of the cathedral?
Yes. Well, let me just come back a bit earlier to the day, the fire. I have to say, everyone at that time, including me, who just happened to be getting out from the metro at Pont-Marie and stood there for 2 hours watching the disaster, everyone saw this yellow-orange smoke rising into the sky that night. And I want to come back to this striking issue, which is that from the very next day, the media was absolutely full, even the international media was absolutely full of talk of a global heritage tragedy, of course, and that the ashes were still hot and there was already discussion of the building's reconstruction and possible architectural perspectives. And on the other hand, there was absolutely nothing at all about the risk of poisoning in the debate at that time. There's an expression in French that for absolute silence on an event, we say silence de plomb, which in English would probably be like complete silence or dead silence. We say lead silence, right? And of course, this play on words was appealing in French. So I used it in an opinion piece I published in the press 2 weeks after the fire. I said there's a lead silence on this issue coming after this Robin des Bois and another Association des Familles Victimes du Saturnisme organization, which described actually Notre Dame as a toxic waste. But unsuccessfully called on the public authorities to react. And indeed, the first public reaction came only before the idea of reconstruction with lead. It was just a press release from the police and health authorities joined together, indicating that lead samples had been taken on the soil in the vicinity of the cathedral, but immediately minimizing the extent of the pollution. And there was this idea of a vigilance zone, which was not defined. The risk of exposure was really minimized, limiting risk to the workplace and not the environment. And what they would call local residents were advised, but without defining how far away from the cathedral was local residents. So they were asked to clean their homes with wet wipes to prevent the release of lead dust, which was obviously completely useless 2 weeks after the fire. So there was absolutely nothing about screening, about testing vulnerable populations, such as young children and pregnant women, etc. And people were actually told to cut their fingernails short and wash their hands when they got home. So that was really striking. And I have to say, as Lex has made it clear earlier, when the first measures were taken, they obviously caused a great deal of concern among the public, who had the impression that the potential danger of the lead fallout had been deliberately overlooked in public spaces and even in private homes. I was thinking, for example, of all the cafes and souvenir stands that are numerous around the cathedral, whose probably key rings and caps had been covered with lead dust and would have had to be cleaned one by one. So it was not until several weeks and even several months the following summer that a paper in the press made this story public and urging the city authorities to carry out a blood test among children in the close area, which actually did not give very worrying results, except on a few children, two or three, allowing the authorities to say that the public had probably been worried for too little, you know. And that was the moment where the main head of the Paris police declared that no one would actually lick the sidewalks, as he would say. You know, you had to lick the sidewalks to be poisoned by lead, which of course sparked a public outcry. So actually, when the President Macron decided to rebuild the cathedral with lead, it was reportedly a personal decision by President Macron. The context, of course, is very important to state, because the context is that the Olympic Games were scheduled for 2024 and that the cathedral absolutely had to be rebuilt for that inauguration of the Olympics, since Paris was going to be like the center of the world during that summer, you know. And so starting to think about alternatives, like whether metallic alternative where copper was addressed, for example, or with like innovative materials which do exist, that would have required technical feasibility tests to be carried out, which would have taken a lot of time and delayed the rebuilding site. So he therefore decided in the summer of 2020, so that 1 year after the fire, that the cathedral would be rebuilt identically, including in terms of material used, and that is with more than 400 tons of lead. It was a surprise, of course, because obviously it meant denying the hazards of lead that experts had been publicly highlighting since the fire. But I have to say at the same time that as a historian, it didn't really surprise me, because working over the long term on the processes that make the dangers of lead invisible in the public sphere, you can't be surprised of this kind of decision. And I have to say the history of lead is a long history of like opacity and denial of risk, of which the story of the rebuilding of Notre Dame is the latest chapter, but certainly not the last one.
Lex, turning to you and perhaps adopting a comparative perspective with the United States, I was wondering what your take was on the role of civil society, particularly in the US, and the way in which for a long time, civil society groups in America have tried to raise awareness of the dangers of lead exposure, including through its use in paint, and the effects that it has on children. How would you compare the US and France with regards to, you know, raising awareness of the risk posed by lead pollution?
So perhaps I'll go back to a decision that Judith referred to, which was to go ahead with adding lead to gasoline. In her own book, Judith points out that when this was proposed, there was already sufficient knowledge to say that this was not a good idea. And then my understanding is that pressure from the industry allowed this to go ahead. So I wouldn't say that the US record is so fantastic on that front. And also lead-based paint, which you refer to, was banned only in the late 1970s in the US. So many homes have been painted until then with lead-based paint. And the U.S. is living with a legacy from that. So often homes that have been, built in the first half of the 20th century, especially if they are dilapidated. I know some particular areas in Newark, for instance. The children living in those areas have a higher blood lead level on average than some of the other wealthier neighborhoods surrounding this particular area. So I think the Centers for Disease Control in the U.S. has played an important role in alerting people to this problem, fixing this problem once it has been created by delayed banning of lead-based paint. It turns out to be a very tough task. One big difference between the U.S. and France, and it will be bring me back to Notre Dame as well, is that in a number of states like New York or New Jersey, every child is supposed to be tested for lead, so the blood of a child is supposed to be tested for lead within the first 2 years of the life of this child. And so this has produced an enormous database of information that, you know, allows you to look for patterns like the one for a certain neighborhood of Newark that I just described. And this must be this is enormously valuable. It brings it back to people's attention, and this is communicating to the parents and leads to interventions by, for instance, the New York City Department of Health. But one of the issues of the limited blood lead sampling that was conducted after Notre Dame is that there was no there is no really representative data set to compare what was observed. When blood is tested in France, it's because there's reasons for concern. And so just that means that the average will be, you know, higher than the overall average. And so if you then look sort of a post Notre Dame, you compare that, you say, well, it doesn't look like it had a big effect. Because France doesn't, in France there is no routine monitoring of the general population, there was no real, you know, basis for comparison of the blood lead samples collected in the aftermath of Notre Dame. So I would say early on, a lot of exposure that was produced industrially lasted for a long time in the US. Today, a lot more monitoring than in Europe. It's worth pointing out that the leaded gasoline was banned in the U.S. about a decade earlier than in Europe. And I'm told that it wasn't actually because of lead, but it was because lead poisoned the catalytic converters that were required to reduce other types of emissions in California specifically. It still wasn't lead itself that caused a change in policy.
Right, and policy as often was led out of one of the states, also in the United States, it seems, from what you're saying. Judith, I'm curious about your take on the role of regulation, which was mentioned by Lex as well. How effective is regulation? What kind of regulation already exists? Is there regulation at regional EU or World Health Organization level? And how have these tools been used in order to raise awareness in the public, but also leverage political decisions?
Well, this is a very complex question, I think. But overall, it can be said that the fight against the hazards of lead has suffered from a quite extraordinary paradox. Compared to other toxic products, which are more complex and probably less well known to the general public, lead has been used since a very, very long time, as I told you, since antiquity, probably even earlier, and it's very well known. And it's something like a familiar substance which has been used in everyday products for centuries. I'm thinking of lead pencils or lead soldiers, which have now disappeared from our children's bedrooms, but which were still common in the 1950s or probably 60s before they were substituted with plastics, actually, which is another toxic problem. Toxicological knowledge has progressed, and we've come to realize how dangerous this product is. But that hasn't stopped industry from continuing to use it for decades. I have studied in depth the issue of lead paint, and I have to say this paradox lies in the fact that lead pigments in paint were first developed for use in the white paint that has covered most buildings since the beginning of the urban and industrial era, even though it was well known that their manufacturing and use were actually dangerous processes. The scientific and technical knowledge was there, obviously, and yet we still developed this production. And this is what I showed in my book, actually. Like, when lines of workers from the sector were going to hospitals, attempts were made to develop alternatives, such as zinc paint, for example, in the 19th century and early 20th century. But it was practically impossible to substitute the toxic product with a non-toxic one. For example, with the zinc paint, there is a question of economic policy, political choice in favor of one product rather than another. And this policy has extended over the long term. In France, for example, at the time of the First World War, zinc paint was condemned as a German product and therefore a product of the enemy. And this campaign was, of course, driven by the national lead industry in France. And it worked very well because house painters were used to this product. And the reputation of lead paint was better than that of zinc paint, which was considered to be of a lesser quality. But there's also a certain lack of concern on the part of probably both the public authorities and the general public for this disease, which first affected the working classes and then the population of, rundown urban areas from the 1970s and 80s onwards, who often were African-American in the US, Indo-Pakistani origin in Great Britain, or African descent people in France and so on. So these are population with many other social and health problems. And in the end, the issue of lead poisoning was quite widely considered secondary to the other problems these population were facing. Apart from this, which is the socio-economic context, I would say the wear regulation, like the French Parliament banned the use of lead paint as early as 1909. So that's very, very early. But this regulation was not really implemented and followed up. Then the ILO banned it in its member states. The US was not part of this at that time.
The International Labour Organization.
Yes, International Labour Organization, as early as 1921. But it also had little effect. But finally, I think that lead paint has largely disappeared from the paint market because it was not recommended or even banned in some countries, but mostly because technical, more effective paints came onto the market from the 1950s onward, and it's rather an issue of technical ability of the paint and technical efficiency of the paint itself or the product than of regulation to my eyes. So this pollution should eventually diminish, but there are still plenty of other sources of lead poisoning, including electronic waste, for example, which contains lead and many other toxic metallic substances. So I just feel like there's a mixture of, to answer your question, like a mixture of negligence, opacity of scientific knowledge, which is there, but which is not tackled by public authorities or even by people. And this scientific knowledge does not really succeed in like integrating the public sphere. It is this context which explains the permanence, the maintenance, even today, of a certain negligence or indifference regarding this issue.
Right. Lex, you wanted to add a point on this. Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to point out that unfortunately in at least a dozen countries worldwide, lead-based paint is still sold. I can tell you from first experience that in the leading solvent-based brand of paint in Abidjan, Côte d'Ivoire, contains 5, 10, 20% lead, even though local regulations completely forbids that. So there's the legacy, but even the production of more legacy today in terms of exposure to lead paint, unfortunately.
Which brings me also to my last question with regards to the impact of lead exposure and lead contamination in other parts of the world, and particularly in the South. You've worked in many countries in the South, Lex, as well. When it comes to lead exposure, you've mentioned this case which touches on regulation which is not abided to, but what are the other specific challenges faced in countries, for example, in Asia or in sub-Saharan Africa, and what solutions are being put forward?
So I'm a little bit more familiar with the mining world, but this is relevant to the paint story as well. And the big challenge there is heterogeneity. It's the fact that a contaminant like lead, the hotspots, will be hotspot. It's not a uniform contamination. And as a mother, you want to know where your child is being exposed. And so what you really would like every family to be able to do is to test the soil of the areas where a particular child plays. And so we had a project that was funded by USAID in Peru, where we had mothers with young children. We gave them a kit to collect the samples, and they actually discovered hotspots that we had overlooked by doing a more standard sort of sampling grid-based pattern. So this heterogeneity is a huge challenge for any sort of government to try to address the problem. I think the extent of monitoring in the US, of blood lead monitoring, I think that is a that would be a great thing if this were more widespread, and it's not that costly. It's more logistics than actual cost of the measurement. But some people say, well, but that's too late, because once you measure the lead in the blood, the child has been exposed. What you really need is more environmental measurements to avoid this from happening in the first place. And I tend to agree with that. And so one of the things that we try to do in my lab is to develop kits that anybody can use to try to measure, say, lead in soil. This could be a former mining town like Lavrion in Greece. It could be around a battery production factory that emitted a lot of lead for many years in Lille, in northern France, and mining areas, as I said, in Peru. So I see it as a problem where you need government action, you need regulation, but you also need participation by people more generally, and that means you need to create awareness, you need to give people the tools. You shouldn't expect people to want to pay for these testing tools in different contexts. We've tried to see how willing people are to pay for these sorts of kits, and the willingness to pay is very low. So they really should be provided for free, and instead should be encouraged to use them. And if possible, this information should be compiled in some anonymized way so that action can be based on that.
Well, that's a very inspiring project and a very optimistic note to end on. I'd like to thank both of you, Professor Rainhorn, Professor Van Ghen, for raising the issue of lead pollution and bringing our attention to a challenge, actually, that I believe still remains too much under the radar in the world today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Vis-a-vis is brought to you by the Alliance Program, a partnership between Columbia University, Paris Panthéon Sorbonne, Sciences Po, and École Polytechnique. This podcast is produced by Rachel Kahn and Georgia O'Neill, and I'm Emmanuel Catan. Special thanks to Esther Jackson and her colleagues at Columbia Libraries. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. If you're interested in learning more about the Alliance Program and how we support academic exchanges, research, and collaboration between the US and France, please visit us at alliance.columbia.edu or follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening.